Coming up next on People Rise Up, we'll have an update of what's going on with the WTO in advance of their Hong Kong ministerial in mid-December. Good morning. You are listening to People Rise Up on your non-commercial community radio station, KBOO, here in Portland, Oregon. My name is Andrew Geller, and we're going to be talking all about the World Trade Organization this morning. And they have a ministerial coming up December 13 through 18 in Hong Kong. This follows up on the Cancun ministerial, failed Cancun ministerial of 2003, the sort of failed Doha ministerial of 2001, the obviously failed Seattle ministerial in 1999, and Singapore prior to that, which they still got issues related to that Singapore meeting from the late 90s that they're talking about. And joining me this morning to provide us with first-hand accounts of what's going on over there in Geneva, Switzerland at WTO Central, I'm pleased to bring to you Karen Smaller. She is a project officer with the Trade Information Project of the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, which is based in Minneapolis. So welcome to our airwaves, Karen.
Thanks, Andrew, and thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Now, we got a whole ton of stuff to try and squeeze into the next 27 minutes here, and I want to take a minute here to provide a little bit of context for the rest of the half hour. Now, as I mentioned, there are many unresolved issues over the course of many years' worth of conversations, and we're going to talk a bunch about that. But there are also newer issues that the WTO tries to incorporate. And that's providing its own source of stress for many, many countries. But before we get into any topic-specific information about what the talks, the substance of the talks, I want to talk a little bit about what undergirds all of this, which is the issue of the process, its transparency, and how inclusive the negotiations in between the ministerial meetings are. Could you give us a little sense of what you observe when you track the WTO there in Geneva about process and transparency and inclusiveness?
Yeah, I think probably one of the issues, the biggest that we face here is exactly this issue of process and of transparency and inclusiveness. And this is not just in relation to the public's ability to access and find out what's going on, but more importantly, it's about actual members of the institution not being able to effectively participate and not being able to get access to information about what's going on. And you find that happening more and more and intensifying as you get closer to a ministerial meeting. few months. In the last months, the process has gone completely underground. In some instances, you have only the two major powers, the United States and the European Commission, negotiating together. At other instances, you might have four parties, the States, the United States, the European Commission, India, and Brazil. At other moments, they add one extra member, sometimes Australia, and then there are different variations. But the majority of the membership is excluded from this and only finds out at a later point, if they're lucky, about what's happened. And you see a lot of discontent among the membership about this issue of transparency and inclusiveness, and about the fact that they are going to be forced to sign an agreement which they haven't been party to and they haven't been able to effectively contribute to. And it's definitely a major concern. It's a major concern for civil society groups working on WTO issues. It's a major concern for those countries that are excluded. And there is definitely a risk that a ministerial meeting can fail because of how exclusive and untransparent the process is.
Well, and that's what I found when I was in Seattle in 1999 and watched from inside the final day just collapse. I mean, I spoke with people from all over what's considered widely the global south, although all those countries aren't necessarily in the southern hemisphere, but delegates, NGO representatives, staff aides to delegates, all saying, you know, we're not even being told they're taking where meetings place, or if they're taking place, and they expect us to give a thumbs up or thumbs down on this. You know, we can't vote for something that we're not involved in, and it's not involved. It's really, I suppose in a sense it's discouraging and in a sense encouraging that the problem has not been resolved. And I guess, as you said, intensifies any time a ministerial approach.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. I mean, I think that there have definitely been efforts and improved to try to improve information flows to delegates, to different country missions, but certainly not adequately enough. And the bigger issue of actually being able to participate is much greater than the issue of transparency. So even if you inform people about what's happening, if they're not participating in it, you can't force them to sign these agreements.
And I think that's what we saw take place in Cancun, Mexico, to a large extent, the fall of 2003, when that ministerial failed. You had many countries, what I guess now is sort of referred to as the G20, group of 20 countries, many larger, colloquially referred to as lesser countries, developed countries, being led by Brazil, India, and sometimes China, really stopping the agriculture negotiations coming out of the Doha round that were then brought to Cancun for further negotiation. And, you know, those countries just said, look, you guys aren't playing fair. We're stopping this. And because of the consensus nature of the WTO, any single country who doesn't agree to an agreement stops the process right there. So let's move forward. Following the failure in Seattle, they went to Doha, Qatar in 2001 and came up with what has been referred to since as the Doha Development Round. Why don't you summarize real briefly the purpose of the Doha Round of Negotiations, and then we'll get into some of the details of it.
Well, the Doha negotiations were launched in response to the fact that the Uruguay round, the round that preceded Doha, was seen to cause a lot of injustices and a lot of inequalities within the international trading system, and was seen to really cause further disadvantage to countries developing and their ability to participate in the trading system. And so the rich governments of the world sold this round to poor countries by saying, your round, this is about development. This is about changing the flaws in the existing agreements. This is defining the correct imbalances. And this is about promoting development in your countries through trade. And it was in that backdrop that this agreement was sold. And so the central piece of the Doha agenda is agricultural trade, because it was seen that where developing countries have the most to benefit is from agricultural trade. What ended up then happening, if you actually look at the details of the Doha agenda, was that there was a big stink made about how much the US and the EC were going to give in terms of agriculture, that they demanded to have further market access openings in areas of interest to them, which include in service provision, in service sectors, in industrial products, and in intellectual property, just to name a few. So when you actually look at the details of the Doha agenda, most civil society groups were vehemently opposed to it and strongly criticized it, because it was clear from the outset that this was not going to be a development round, and this was not going to contribute to rectify the imbalances in the trading rules and to creating fairer and more equitable and a fairer and more equitable trading system.
Okay, well, let's dive into a little bit about agriculture here, because as you mentioned, that is the key sticking point in terms of negotiations. And just as a caveat, I will reference what European Union Trade Commissioner Peter Mandelson keeps saying, which is that this round is not only about agriculture, and the EU is not the only country or the only block negotiating that needs to give more regarding agriculture. Many countries are saying that currently it is the EU that is holding up agriculture talks there in Geneva. Had a general council meeting last Wednesday and Thursday, the 19th and 20th, and that was preceded earlier by a week earlier, the G20 meeting on the 10th and 11th. And the G20, again, is the group of 20 countries that basically shut the Cancun Minister, led by Brazil and India, over agriculture talks. So in agriculture, there's three key issues: that of domestic subsidies, market access, and dumping. So why don't we go first to what's widely acknowledged as the key issue within agriculture, and that's the issue of domestic subsidy support. Can you tell us what's kind of the crux of that and key players, and you know what's going on with the back and forth?
Yep, definitely. I think I would start this discussion to say one of the biggest criticisms that we have over what's happening in the agriculture negotiations at the WTO is that it's not going to address this issue of dumping. Dumping is a practice whereby one country will sell, or the exporters of a country will sell its agricultural products in another country at below what it costs to produce that product. And the impact is that you then displace any local production, and you can put farmers, small-scale farmers and family farmers, further into poverty because you've displaced their production by your cheap exports.
And just for reference, it's the production cost in the other country, not the exporting country, that's the issue.
For us, it's the cost of production in the country. So if the U.S., if it costs them $100 a ton to make a ton of rice, then if they sell it at $40 a ton, then they're selling it at below the cost of production. So it is from the country that's exporting it.
Okay, my mistake.
That's okay. And the U.S. is one of the worst violators of dumping. They're one of the countries that is one of the most egregious dumpers. So I think if you look at the WTO agreements, this is probably in the biggest justice, and this is something that the current agriculture negotiations are not tackling. The current negotiations are largely the issue of tackling subsidies and the issue of trade measures or tariffs. And this is where we're concerned that this focus being on the subsidies is diverting us away from the real issue, which is dumping. On the issue of subsidies, though, because it is a really interesting issue and a lot's happened in the last few weeks, seen big proposals coming both from the US and the EC to say that they're willing to cut their domestic subsidies, their most trade-distorting domestic subsidies, by, for the US, 60%, and for the EU, 70%. And so to the rest of the world, this is seen as a huge concession. I mean, to think that they're going to be reducing all these subsidies by such huge amounts seems on face to be a huge concession. Mm-hmm. The reality is that when you look at the proposals on the table, you realize that when it comes to the EC, they're actually not going to have to make any real cuts to their subsidies because they had an internal reform in 2000 that allowed them to shift their subsidies around and so not actually have to sustain the cuts. And with the US, the proposal of a 60% cut, if we've analyzed it and it looks more like they're going to be actually only reducing around 5%, not by 60%. And nevertheless, they're being hailed by the whole world as making huge steps to get rid of their subsidies, to offer something to poor countries. And yet at the same time, we know in reality they're not going to be making any reductions.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KO Radio in Portland, Oregon. My guest today is Karen Smaller. She is a project officer with the Trade Information Project in Geneva, Switzerland, for the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. You can find out more about what they're doing online at www.iatp.org, or if you want to just go to the trade site, www.tradeobservatory.org. Lots of headline news, lots of documents, lots of links, action, etc. There's also links to them and many other sources of information regarding the WTO and the upcoming Hong Kong ministerial. People write at this UP website, which you can get to at www.kboo.fm. Go to the program schedule, click the show, and there's the links. Now, the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy actually just released a new report analyzing the U.S. proposal and says exactly what you just mentioned, in that the proposal, although it looks like it's got some really big numbers in it, won't amount to actual significant change if implemented. And that report will have a link to from the People Rise Up website if people want to get into and get deep that. Okay, so there's been a lot of, and I've been reading press for about 2 weeks all about this, European, primarily in an Asian press, not so much the U.S. media. It's kind of interesting. And it focuses on the U.S. versus the EU or the EC, the European Commission, in the negotiations. And don't hear a lot about, hear a whole Brazil, India, or Australia in these talks. I assume they're participating as full partners and the U.S. and EU aren't just off into a kind of going off corner and figuring this out on their own.
I think that's one sense right. I mean, the India, Brazil, and Australia, but in particular India and Brazil, mm-hmm. have definitely come to the forefront of these negotiations as participants. And you watch this, you mentioned before, the rise of the G20 at the Cancun ministerial, and that's really gathered a lot of momentum since Cancun, and they've really become a force to reckon with in the negotiations. In days gone by, there was often just the US and the EC that would negotiate between themselves and then impose that impose agreement there onto the rest of the membership. Today, that's more unlikely to happen because of the force that the G20 has had in changing some of those power relations. The reality, however, is still that the US and the EC are the two major trading powers, and they are the ones who are expected to give concessions, specifically pressure in terms of the subsidy scheme in these negotiations. And in that sense, because they are the major trading powers, because they're the two major economic forces, it's still very much about what they're willing to do in these negotiations.
Now, in the context of the agriculture talks, and I want to shift away from this so we can bring another topic in, we run out of time before we time, but in the agriculture talks, the U.S., the EU, Brazil, India, and Australia are referred to as the five interested parties, and they had negotiations. Let me see here. If I flip to the back, they had negotiations on the 11th group as a and then again the 18th, 19th, and 20th of October. I forget which of the, I guess it must have been the 18th through 20th, where they met for one evening and they called the rest of the talks off because they just realized nothing was happening.
Exactly. I mean, this is where the deadlocks come in the last few weeks, where people are saying the European Commission is refusing to move. It's facing some internal crises. It's put an offer on the table that has not been accepted to the other major players. But at the same time, it's being told it can't give any more in agriculture unless it gets something more in the other areas of the negotiations, in particular in the services sector and in the sector of industrial products. Plus, it's facing a huge internal crisis. So you've seen the EU being very resistant, and the other four members of this informal grouping demanding that the EC comes up with something. And so you've seen them try and meet in this five interested parties grouping and talks collapsing and failing almost instantly, because the EC is no longer, is stalling for the moment.
Now, let's move away from agriculture for the moment. And I know we didn't talk about access market as such, but people interested will pursue information on their own about it. Let's talk a little bit about services, but not a whole ton, because I've got non-issue-oriented questions that I will sneak in but want to try and for the end. So can you tell us what's going on with services? This is one of these Singapore issues that's been kind of dangling for almost 10 years now.
Actually, services is another big pillar in these negotiations, and the main issues that are happening there is that how countries negotiate service sectors is that each country makes an offer and says, for example, I will liberalize my financial sector, and then it requests from other countries, but I would like you to liberalize, for example, your education sector or your health sector. So there's a lot of bilateral negotiations that are happening in the services negotiations. That's a big issue that's happening, and it's seen as something that gives a degree of flexibility, because it's about your requests and your offers. There's no set of modalities that you have to give commitments in subsidies and market access, and which is different to the way the agriculture negotiations work. The interesting development that's happened recently in services is that many of the aggressive service countries, the countries who are demanding liberalization, further liberalization in service sectors, particularly developed countries, have been unsatisfied with the offers that have been on the table. So there's been this attempt to create some kind of benchmark level for the minimum amount of services offers that you can make. And this has caused a huge outcry within the negotiations, because many countries feel this is unfair. This removes the flexibility to say what you will be offering and what you will be requesting, and says that you have to offer a minimum. And the implications for services liberalization is obviously huge, and countries want to be able to have the flexibility to decide whether they even do offer a particular service sector, whether they do want to offer up their water sector, for example, to liberalization, which could increase privatization. Whether they want to open up their education sectors or their health sectors to private firms. As new and the initiative largely coming from the European Commission to create these benchmarks has caused a big stir in the services negotiations.
Well, and then last Wednesday, Brazil's foreign minister, Celso Amorim, said that it was too early to begin discussing the opening of service industries, which is a whole nother negotiating position that we won't have time to go into today, but very interesting that one of the large sort of I hate the phrase lesser developed countries, but anyway, one of the larger countries in the negotiations are saying, we're not ready to go there, which gets to the whole issue of, are we going to assess what has been done in the past 10 years of the WTO before we add new things in to see if we can, you know, learn from mistakes, benefit new sectors that are included for talks, or are we just going to plow ahead, same old, and, you know, worry about repercussions later? We've got about 3 or 4 minutes left here, and I want to move away from issue-specific things for the last little bit here. I'm curious about your perspective on the power of the Group of 20 in the upcoming Hong Kong ministerial, and this is led by Brazil and India.
I think they will be a major force, and I think that on the one hand, they've now very much committed themselves to wanting an agreement, to wanting an outcome in Hong Kong. And so on the one hand, while they'll definitely be a very powerful player in these negotiations, they do agreement. And so you might be seeing more resistance to the proposals on the table by a group like the G90, which consists of least developed countries, African of the countries, and of the Africa, Caribbean and Pacific Island countries. So you might be seeing a lot of this resistant voice that you saw coming from the G20 in Cancun actually coming from a different grouping of developing countries. At the same time, they've obviously got a close relationship, these other countries, the developers, with the Group of 20. But I think we'll be seeing the Group of 20 led by Brazil and India playing a much more active role in trying to get an agreement out and role in less of a resisting what is on the table.
Okay. Not to put you on the spot, but in a word, do you think there's going to be an agreement coming out of Hong Kong?
The way things look now, I think there will be an agreement.
Okay.
I don't think it will be a good agreement.
Okay. If there is no agreement coming out of Hong Kong, and again, I'm going to need to just have you be brief on this. Do you think the WTO will be considered relevant if there's no agreement in Hong Kong? And what happens to the Doha round if nothing happens in Hong Kong?
I think the WTO will still stay relevant because I think there is a need for multilateral trade rules. And I don't think, no matter in how much crisis this institution is, that it won't disappear if Hong Kong fails, because there is a need for a body to regulate multilateral trade rules.
Okay, fair enough. My guest this morning has been Karen Smaller. She is a project officer with the Trade Information Project of the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, and she joined us from her office in Geneva. Thanks for sticking around late in the day this morning. Talk with us.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
And for more information about the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy's Trade Information Project, you can go to their website, which is www.iatp.org or www.tradeobservatory.org. The People Rise Up website at kboo.fm also has links to them, as well as many other resources, documents, news stories, etc., etc. As you might imagine, there is tremendous opposition to the WTO ministerial gearing up all across the Eurasian continent as well as elsewhere. The People's Caravan kicked off a few days ago, and as I mentioned, there will be links to many things, many, many activist-oriented opposing the WTO. If you have any feedback regarding this or any other People Rise Up program, feel free to send me email, kboo@riseup.net. You can also send paper mail here to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 92714. Not sure what's happening next week on the program quite yet, I do appreciate you listening.